Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. By God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous, rooms full of people like you, and a little bit of effort on my own, I haven't had to take a drink or do any dope since May the 11th, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. I'm glad to be here. Yeah. All right. I'm glad to be here in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a privilege to be able to participate in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a special privilege to be able to participate with my wife, for both of us to be asked to participate in the respective programs is always a compliment to our way of living today and allows us to do the things that we enjoy doing together. And for Sue and I to be invited anywhere is especially a miracle. It's not a success story, but I guarantee when we came to the program, nobody was inviting us anywhere. Our nickname was Hatchet and Hammer. But, you know, through the wonderful work of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, we have changed our way of life and found Jesus, and we're a lot better now. It's always good to see some of my friends and some of the people that I've been able to share this program with, or Taper. I've known him for some time and share some friendship with his sponsor. Our speaker tomorrow, Frank, is a four-star speaker. You're going to just be overwhelmed tomorrow. It's always a privilege to be with these people, and Sister B lives in California close to us, and so she'll save us on Sunday, so be sure and come Sunday so that you can get saved. And tonight we'll just, you know, have a little AA and get it on, because that's what I like to do. I like to get it on. I've always liked to just get it on, man. There's people who wait for things to happen. There's people who watch things happen. There's people who make things happen. And I just like to get it on. That's, you know, I've always been that way. I don't know. There's something about it, I guess. I was born in Texas, and that doesn't necessarily make me an alcoholic. It gave me certain characteristics I've always had. I guess maybe some of my ethnic background. I've always had the ability to recognize your character defects, and I've always had a need to tell you about them. That made drinking a contact sport for me, is what it did. I ran into a lot of things, a lot of places. And I don't know if I was born an alcoholic. It really doesn't make any difference to me whether I was born an alcoholic or not. I know when I took my first drink, an alcoholic was born. Somewhere between my first drink out of that jug to the bottom of that jug, I crossed over that invisible line. And the book talks about the invisible line, and I don't remember the trip. I was loaded when it happened, so I I started drinking at an early age. I don't know if that was anything that it was just available. I grew up in an alcoholic home, an alcoholic environment. I'm at least a fourth generation alcoholic, and I don't blame any of those people for me being an alcoholic. I worked just as hard. I put 110% into being an alcoholic. I'll guarantee you. I can't blame anybody. Matter of fact, you know, there's a lot of, you know, programs and what have you now today that are looking into, you know, where we come from as a result of, you know, what we did and as a result of why we're here and this and that and the other. And I think it's one of my greatest assets. You know, I grew up in an alcoholic home, and if you can grow up and survive with selfish, self-centered, neurotic, insane people, you're a winner if you get out of there alive. And it's amazing, you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and say, we're home, and you sit down in a room full of selfish, self-centered, neurotic, insane people. So, you know, if you can make it here, you're a winner, you know. And I know today the difference between the winners and losers is just simply the winners are willing to do the things that the losers are not willing to do. And I just stick with the winners, you know, one day at a time. And I've been able to stay around here for a while, but I know what it's like if you're new or relatively new to being a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous if you're not really an alcoholic. I mean, really. Really. Because I went to Alcoholics Anonymous and I wasn't an alcoholic. I was almost an alcoholic. Everybody around me said I was an alcoholic, but I wasn't an alcoholic. And if you ain't an alcoholic, you just ain't an alcoholic, man. And that's the most miserable time of my life, I'll guarantee you, bar none. But I made it, you know. So I've had a lot of experiences. I've been places and did a lot of things. I give you an idea of kind of what I was like out there. I don't know how to identify. I don't identify with anybody specialized. If you specialize, well, that's fine. I'm a pig myself. I did anything, anytime, anywhere. I used to drink a little beer and think maybe I ought to do something and smoke a little weed and kind of fantasize how I was going to do it. And then I'd do a little speed so I'd have the strength to do it, you know, and then I'd do a little coke so I could be cool whenever I did it. And then I'd drink a little whiskey and forget what the hell it was I was going to do, you know. So. I just like to do it. I've always been that way. I don't care what it is. Deal me in. I've always been that way. Deal me in, man. I'm ready. 50 cents, 50 million. Let's go. Get it on. And, you know, I'm not a whole lot different than that today. I like to do it. I like to be where the action is, you know. And if sobriety was boring, I wouldn't be here, man. I love the enthusiasm of life. I love the enthusiasm of places like this and the people and, you know, the excitement and just the buzz and the hum, you know. I did a lot of amphetamines. That's like going 190 mile an hour with your feet nailed to the floor, you know? I mean, it's just... That's kind of the way it is when you're sitting down there waiting for them to announce you. You know, there's nothing worse than getting the message unless it's waiting to get the message, you know? And I just... You know, I've been that way all my life. I don't know if it's just the way I was. Yeah. I started out drinking at an early age because it was available, and I progressed... You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about the effect of alcohol, and the effect is that after some amount of consumption, you can't distinguish the difference between right and wrong, true or false. And I like that effect. I like that feeling. I like what it did to me. I don't know that I was, felt weird and different and an alien on some kind of a planet. Some people explain those things. I really never stopped to analyze it, tell you the truth. I utilized it. And, you know, I had those feelings, I'm sure. I was scared. I was a scared little boy, and I grew up to be a scared little boy. And fear is my partner. I understand fear. Fear has been with me all my life. And, you know, fear demobilizes some people. And my type of person, fear is, I drive fear like a fast car. It comes out in me in anger and rage. And I've always been that way as long as I can remember. I just blaze right on through it. And, you know, by the time I was 13, 14 years old, I got in a lot of trouble. You get in a lot of trouble. My father's a lawyer and a drunken lawyer at that time. And I have never been resentful for the fact that my father put a lot of effort into going to law school, because I'll guarantee you I always needed a lawyer. And kept him on retainer for years, you know. And now he's sober in AA, and, you know, we got a good relationship. But for years, it was just, you know, just get me out of trouble, that's all. And I'd get in a lot of trouble. People always wanted to study my behavior pattern. And they wanted to answer that stupid question. Why? Why'd you do that? I didn't know why I did that. I never stopped to think why I did that. I just did it. You know, I never had much guilt. I had a little guilt right when I get caught. You know, just a little bit, just a little glimpse of it. But you can't dwell on it too long, because you got to think about what it is you got to do to get out of trouble. And since I'm a fast study, you know, with those characteristics, I'm a good thief too. I like to steal. God knows I'm a thief, and I know I'm a thief. Now you know I'm a thief. I just like to steal. It's exciting. I like the chaotic part of it. I like the setup, man. I like the deal. And by the time I was 18, 19 years old, well, I'd been locked up. I'd been observed. I'd been married and divorced. I'd been around, and I enjoyed it. I was having a lot of fun, doing a lot of things, going places, and I got out of jail down in Texas, got on a train, and headed for Amarillo, going home. Always went home to rest, you know. Got to rest, and when you're busy. And I got on that train and got me a jug of corn whiskey, and I started doing one of them little inventories. We always did them little inventories. Inventory work is not strange to me. And I'm sitting on that train, and I'm thinking about myself. I mean, that's a logical thing to think about. And I'm going back over my life, and I'm thinking, you know, I got to stay out of trouble. I got to stay away from crazy partners of mine. They're always in trouble. And them sick women. I got to stay away from them sick women. Amen. That's one of my biggest character defects. You can line 10 women against that wall, and I'll get the sickest one every time. Man, I love them sick women. Man, they got a hum, man. They're ready. There's a few of them in here. I can feel them. You can feel them. Kind of levitate you, you know. They don't need to stop and pack. They're ready to go, you know. And I'm thinking, problem is, and then fast cars, stay away from them fast cars. I'm thinking about all that, drinking that corn whiskey. And I got up to Amarillo, and two friends of mine, Oily and Goose, picked me up. And they had an old pickup truck with a couple of rifles hanging in the back window and a bunch of 3-2 beer and some white lightning. And we started out for the panhandle up there by Pampa Perryton, and Saturday night. And, you know, all the way up from South Texas on that train, I'm saying, you know, I gotta stay away from these people, stay away from these women, quit drinking this crazy stuff. And, I never stopped at when I crawled in that pickup truck. I remember one time a guy handed me a handful of pills, probably Bennies or something, and I took them, and I had a fruit jar with stuff that looked like white gasoline, and I went, pow, chased that down, it blowed me back against the wall, whoom, I fell down and then jumped straight up and said, God, that's the best stuff I ever had in my life, you know, and just whoom. And I'm saying, I always get in trouble when I do that. And here I crawl in this pickup truck with Oily and Goose, and they hand me that stuff right there. And all the way, it took hours to get out there to Wolf Creek to that little Saturday night dance, and I'm telling them, I got to stay away from crazy women. I got to stay away from all these, you know, wild, parties and all that stuff. And they're saying to me, yeah, you should. I mean, I'm with them, drinking that stuff, telling them I shouldn't do this. And they're telling me, you shouldn't do this. And then they pass the fruit jar around again, you know? I mean, your good friends will always agree with you. You know, I ran around with people that said, if you get in jail, we'll get you out. And hell, if we can't get you out, we'll get in there with you. And they did. And we rolled out in front of that little dance about midnight and hopped out of there and away we went, you know, and went inside. It was kind of boring, it was intermission, and I started to fight. Because I don't like boring. And they'll start a fight, start a commotion. And the only thing is, I don't like to hang around and get beat up. You know, that's no fun. So I'd already scouted out a place to hide, and I ran over to the woman's restroom when the fight started. And as I went in there while this gal was standing there by the door, and I said, tell me when the fight's over. And I run in and hid, and pretty soon she come in there and said, you can come out now, cowboy. And I went out, and the band was playing. And I asked her to dance. Hell, she was handy. She guarded the door. I found out later she finished the fight, too, for Christ's sake, you know. But I forgot to ask that. And since I'm such a quick study and one quick dance, I found out she had a car, job, place to stay, money in the bank, and I fell in love. Automatically. That's typically alcoholic. All the way up out of that jailhouse, all the way up there on that train, I said, I'm going to stay away from these people, I'm going to stay away from these kind of women, stay out of these places. And I get there, and I forgot everything I said. Good thing I didn't take an oath in blood, you know. But there I am, just zipping along. And that night, going home with her and talking to her. And I said, well, I ain't seen you around. She said, I ain't seen you around. Of course, I've been in jail. Nobody had seen me around. She'd been in an unwed mother's home, and I said, well, I've been in jail. She said, well, I've been in an unwed mother's home. And I said, hey, we deserve each other, baby. You know, sick attracts sick, you know. And I said, stick with me and I'll take you places you never been. And she did. I took her all them places, I'll guarantee you. Most times she didn't want to go, but I took her anyway, man. And away we went. And roaring through the life, you know, just the life of an alcoholic, 19 years old, just in trouble all the time. And the thing about them sick women, they, after a while, they want to give you an ultimatum. You know, I don't know why, I ain't going nowhere. Marry me. All right. You know, if I don't, she'll kick me out. So, you know, I'll marry her. No problem. And she said, pregnant. You know, all of a sudden I found myself with all these things. You know, I don't know anything about being a husband. I don't know anything about being a father. I don't know anything about being an employee. I don't even. I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that responsibility is the ability to respond. I didn't know that. And all of a sudden, I find myself with a wife and a kid and, you know, get this place to live, and I end up with a dog and a cat. Now, I'm the kind of guy, I go over to your house and get a dog out of the litter, I'll get the sickest dog every time. You know, I go over to get an Easter bunny for the kid, I get the one with ringworm. You know, I ended up with a 120-pound German Shepherd dog that hated me, always attacking me. I took the dog to obedience class. We both got kicked out of obedience class for being violent, you know. And got this crazy woman and a kid, and, you know, got a cat and a cat for the kid, you know. one morning hungover, they sent me down to take the cat to the veterinarian. I don't know what they did, but it sure made that sucker mad, and he was always attacking me and clawing me, and I had to leave, go out and be with my friends. The people understood me, and I'd go off and stay gone a day or two or a week or two, and then I'd come home and have all my friends with me. They're the guys that don't want to go home and fight with their old lady, so they come over and watch me fight with mine, Got in a lot of trouble. Eventually had to leave Texas. If you're new, they'll talk to you about them trips. They call them in Alcoholics Anonymous, they call them geographic. And when I left Texas, they called it unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. Had to get the hell out of here. Now, I loaded up this woman and a kid and a dog and a cat and everything we had, and we took off for California. And took us 30 days to get there. Most people could make it in three. Had a little trouble along the way now and then. And the only thing that was consistent was the fact that I wasn't consistent. And we finally got there. An amazing thing. Everywhere I go, take me, and I'm the first one to get there. And there I am. And I left Oklahoma, Texas, the panhandle up there to go out there to find and, get a new start and get things rolling. I moved, just like flypaper, right into the neighborhood. It was a little different. There was a bunch of hippies lived on one side of me. I hadn't seen none of that down there where I come from. Them long hairs, they'd take an LSD, take their clothes off and take all that LSD and lay out in the front yard and watch the sun come up and go down, go blind and wander around aimlessly. I hadn't seen none of that. But I'll utilize anything that's available. And I found out real quick that, the guys that live in there was a guy by the name of Doc and a guy by the name of Professor lived next door, And I left Texas to get away from Oily and Goose. I move out in California, move in next to Doc and Professor. Now, that's a step up. Any day it was a question of who's lower companion. But them guys I knew had some valuable information, and sooner or later I was going to need it. And you want to make friends with them. Motorcycle gang lived on the other side of me. I left, to get away from all that crap. And I headed up right there in the neighborhood and set up camp and put her and the kid and the dog and the cat right there in the middle of it, and away I went. And I was doing a little work around the oil fields, and I'd go off with my buddies and stay loaded and drunk, and then I'd get tired, so I'd have to come home, and I'd come home, and this woman, I'd pick up carrying a butcher knife around all the time to defend herself. I don't like knives myself. I like guns. Guns will enhance conversation. You can shoot a .44 mag off next to somebody's ear and they'll pay attention to you. They won't hear nothing, but they'll pay attention to you. But not her, man. She's just crazy. She'd stick that knife right in my stomach. I'd stick that gun right in her nose and I'd say, I'm going to kill you. Shut up. It's like her mouth was attached to the doorknob when I'd get home. There she's yelling, screaming, and just nutting out. And the kid would be bawling and the dog would be barking and the cat would be scratching and, have the big showdown at the front door. And she's just crazy. I said, I'll kill you. He said, go ahead. You're nuts. If I shoot you, you'll die. She said, I know. But whenever you shoot me, it'll knock me backwards, and when I go back, I'm going to gut you on the way out, and you'll die too. There's Oriental warriors that train all their life to get the last kill, and a pre-Al-Anon knows that intuitively. They know that intuitively. I'll tell you something else. If you're a speed freak, there ain't nothing worse than being in a fast lane when you're married to a speed bump. I'll guarantee you. And we get in there and everybody get bedded down, just nuts. A couple of times I tried to sneak up on it. She set pots and pans inside the door, and I'd come in there and I don't know why you'd hear me coming for a block or two, but I'd get in and try to sneak up and I'd step in one of them pans and I always wore cowboy boots, kept my gun in my boot and my toe would turn up, couldn't get my gun out. She's running around stabbing me with a knife and the dog's biting me in the butt and the cat's scratching it. Just insane, I'm trying to say, Daddy's home for God's sakes, leave me alone, Me! And we finally get everybody bedded down so we could rest. And I'm one of those that the book talks about that always woke up. I just went, whoom! I always woke up quick, ready. Whoom! I had to get something to get my heart started, so I'd go out in the kitchen, put about 100 mini bennies in the blender, pour some orange juice, a couple of raw eggs in there, make a little something, and then pour me a big glass of vodka or tequila and hit it a couple of times with some Tabasco sauce so I could call it a Bloody Mary, and pound that down, and I'd have an intuitive thought immediately. Maybe I ought to mow my front yard. Do my civic duty. I didn't have a front yard. I had front dirt. A lot more fun to mow front dirt. You don't need a grass catcher. I go out in the garage, try to find my lawnmower. It's out there somewhere around underneath all the stuff, you know. And, oh, there's my lawnmower. Yeah, well. And you can't find a rope to start it. Why, if you got a load on like I had on, you can push start your lawnmower. I get around the front yard and mow it at 5:30 in the morning. I remember one morning my lawnmower died. They had a very good maintenance program back then. Must have been something I brought from Texas, a philosophy of life, you know. If it don't run, kill it. And I shot my lawnmower with a 44 mag. That's a spiritual experience. Thinking about just covering it up with green concrete, and I'd never have to mow that yard again. And about that time, the cops come, want to run my head in their nightstick 5 or 6 times in the front yard, talk to me about my behavior patterns. She come running out of the house yelling, screaming, don't take him away because he's got a lot more things to do around here. And she'd go nuts, and then the cops would put the handcuffs on her. And I'd say, now you got it right. Get that crazy woman out of here, and we'll all be better. And then some cop would say something rotten dirty about my wife, and I'd have to hit him because you can't talk bad about my wife. I'm the only one who can talk bad about my wife. And then take the handcuffs off her and put them on me and take me down to jail, and she can come down and write a hot check and get me out. Go back home, and you know, what goes up's got to come down, so I'd be a little depressed. So I had an old recliner kind of broken just so you could lay in it just right and, you know, meditate. I always like to meditate with a little Red Mountain wine. And her and the kid and the dog and the cat would line up on their line of contempt over on the other side of the room and look at you with that look, you know, you rotten no good. And I'd drink my wine, and then I'd get my grandpappy's old shotgun out. I had an old Winchester 97 shotgun. I'd drag her out from underneath the chair, make a big deal, and jack it back and stick the barrel in my... It's empty, of course. You know, you don't want to commit suicide until you get a crowd. Anyway. One time I jacked that thing back and seen something red go by. I thought, I wonder what that was. Pulled that thing over and clicked through. That woman put a shell in that gun. Tried to kill me, you know. Blew the air conditioner right out of the window behind me. Almost ruined my hearing in that ear. Couldn't hear out of that ear for about a week. My neighbor had been out there that killed him, you know. Cops come, run my head in their nightstick 5 or 6 times. And they cuff me and take me down to the jailhouse. She'd come down and write a hot check. I'd come on back home, make my big stand. I'd have to figure out, I got to get out of here, man. I got to leave town now. And she'd always had what money we had in the purse. And whatever I was trying to ride or run at that time didn't work very good by then. And so I'd have to make the mad dash, get her purse and her car keys. And I'd run out and make a swoop down and get that and run out and get the keys and put them in the ignition. You know, start the car and throw it in reverse, turn around so I don't hit nobody. I'm backing down the driveway and back down the driveway. When you turn back around, there she is on the hood. Up on the hood, beating on the windshield, banging on the windshield. That'll sober you up. You got a drunk woman, crazy woman up on that hood, beating on there, you know. Geez, I got to pull back up in the driveway and drag her off the hood. And she'd be going nuts and the dog would be barking. And then they send the van with the I Love Me Not sports coat. Hard to be cool in the front yard in a straitjacket. But I could imagine it. I did it pretty good at it. Put on a good show, and they take you down to the nut ward then. And they might tie you down to the table and let you lay there and scream. One time I was laying there in 4-point restraint, yelling and screaming, and I thought, I wonder why I'm screaming. Kind of stepped out of myself there for a second. Well, maybe I ought to check this out. So I quit screaming, and I listened. Everybody else is tied down on the tables beside me was screaming, and I didn't want to be different, so I just screamed with the rest of them. Keep you there for 72 hours observation and take you in the room and get some psychiatrists in there to look at you. You know, they'd look at you with that look. And I'd been there several times by then. I figured, well, maybe I got to give them some kind of a story. So I know what's the matter with me. I was in the big war. I was in the paratroopers. And they give me all this training and everything. You know, I come today for the big jump and put this big pack on me. And they took me up in this airplane, I don't know, 15, 20,000 feet in the air. I'm getting higher and higher and higher and higher. All of a sudden they ring a bell and a light come on. And everybody start jumping and jumping, jumping out the door. And, you know, I come my turn to jump and I couldn't jump, froze the door. And some guy shoved me out the door. And I don't know, I fell 15, 20,000 feet. My chute didn't open. I just fell and fell and fell. And then I landed in a tree and it flung me up over and I lit on my head over there. And I laid there, I don't know how long, man. It hurt all over. And pretty soon some people come got me and took me over here and then over there and they put me in this hospital and they said I damaged my brain. And I take these little pills. When I take these little pills and drink whiskey, I go crazy. And that psychiatrist looked at me and he said, just a minute. And he went to the phone, called her up, said, well, he's at the wrong hospital. You ought to be at the VA hospital. She says, why? He's never been in the service. They kicked him out. Just when I had a good story, she wouldn't go along with it, you know. They come back and they look at him and say, you know, I'll tell you one thing, son. You're a walking encyclopedia of worthless information, and we're going to give you a little card here. And anytime you want it, you can come back and stick it in the slot outside that door and let yourself in, and we'll, you know, talk to you. You know, I may be sick. I'm not stupid, man. There's no doorknobs on the inside of them doors in the nut house. I never knowingly or willingly went back and stuck my card in that slot and let myself in there. I ended up back in there some more, but I never did it on my own. Well, you got to be crazy to do that. But I did take that card down to the bar where I hung out and showed it to all my friends, and that impressed them. If you're a card-carrying nut, certifiably nuts, home away from home, they'll give you a nickname like psycho and animal and stuff like that. You got a card like that, credentials like that. You know, I did that until I couldn't do it anymore, and then I found myself standing in front of a judge one more time, and he's talking to me about me, and he's got the right guy. And through the course of the conversation, while he's talking to me about going to jail for a period of time that I wasn't certain that I'd be able to handle that, and through the course of the conversation with my parole officer, why, he discussed the possibility that I might go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't know anything about something, they ain't got nothing to fear. I knew something about jail, and I didn't want to go to jail. So they offered me an option to go to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they'd postpone my parole violation and let me go to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they set me up with a deal that day, and I got back home, and my wife had gone to see the lawyer again and again and again, and he finally told her, you know, maybe I'm an alcoholic, you should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she didn't know anything about that, but she brought that information home, and I'd been to see the judge, and he'd give me this kind of a court card deal and let me go to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd made a phone call and contacted a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so when she came home and said her lawyer said I should go to Alcoholics Anonymous, I said, you got the smart lawyer. I should go. Matter of fact, I think I'll go. They have a meeting tonight. It starts at 8:30. It's over at 10 right over here at church. And so I laid down and I started thinking, you know how we are. We've got to do one of them little inventories. And I laid there and she fixed something to eat and ate a little something and... pretty soon, about 8 o'clock, she come over there and said, get up. She stuck that butcher knife right in my face, and cops had taken my guns away. I couldn't defend myself, and by then I had a couple of reference points. One time I passed out on her 15 minutes into a 2-hour conversation. She stabbed me a whole bunch on my back while I was passed out, and then when I came to, I said, my God, something's wrong with my back. She said, oh, let me see. And she looked at my back. Oh, you've been drinking that old whiskey and your back's broke out of acne of the back. Let me put some rubbing alcohol on it. She poured rubbing. So I had a reference point. When she stuck that knife in my face, I knew she's serious. And I got up and we went out and got in the car and we went over to the church and pulled up in front of the church. Had a big AA sign out in front. And I'm thinking, man, if the guys from the neighborhood see me over here, I've sunk to the bottom for sure, you know. She said, what time's the meeting start? I said, 8:30. It's over at 10. I'm going to tell you something, Ace. If your ass comes out of that door before 10, I'm going to gut you. Now, you can keep a guy like me in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting if you got a crazy woman circling the perimeter out here. I'll stay in here. I won't hear nothing, but I'll stay in here. And I went to one meeting a week for 4 months. Never learned nothing. I was so dry as a fire hazard. I mean, I never learned nothing. Well, I did too. I remember one guy said, we won't guarantee you've had your last drink, but we'll guarantee you'll never enjoy another one. I remember that later when I got drunk. I stayed in there for 4 months. Amazing thing happened. I learned something from that. I really did learn a lot of things, come to think of it. I know that there's two kinds of people comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's people come here to change the conditions in their life, and there's people who are coming here to change their life. And if you come here to change the conditions in your life, you know, they're going to change. But you're probably not going to stay. If you come here to change your life, there's a good possibility you get to stay. And I didn't come to change my life. I came to change the conditions in my life. And I'll guarantee you the conditions in my life changed. Going to one meeting a week. I was miserable. My wife said it's the best time we'd had in years. But I was miserable. They talked about all those things. Talked about going to a lot of meetings. Talked about getting a sponsor. Talked about working the steps. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to do nothing. I just wanted to get the heat off. And... going to one meeting a week, sitting there miserable all the time. And after 4 months, I did another one of them little inventories. I was sitting at the house that night and time for the meeting. And by then, there was a little trust there, and she's going to let me go. And I, I looked over and that old dog's laying next to me. I pat him on the head. The cat's in my lap purring. The kid's over here. Pat the kid on the head. She's in the kitchen. I'm back in the big bedroom. Beat the deal down at the courthouse. And I thought to myself, self, you have been too hard on yourself. I mean, I know I'll end up in AA, but I'll be old. And I decided to resign from Alcoholics Anonymous. And amazing thing happened to me when I resigned from Alcoholics Anonymous. I got struck drunk almost immediately. And my life changed. It changed. Never gets better, always gets worse. Always gets worse. And there ain't nothing worse than being out there and having a belly full of booze and a head full of AA. It just drives you crazy. You just know you're a rotten, no-good loser then. And I'll guarantee you, now I'm an angry type dude. I mean, the violence, physical violence. I'm not going to debate with anybody about verbal abuse versus physical abuse or anything like that. But I want you to know, when I was beating up on you, I was talking to you too. I give it my best shot. And that fear inside of me just overwhelmed me. For the next almost 4 years, I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous more out than in, the anger and the fear and those kind of emotions just drove my life. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that I'm supposed to share what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today in a general way. I can look back on my life and thank God I can laugh at, what it used to be like. Thank my God today that I can look at that and see the humor in it. And the humor is very, very important in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's an unbelievable thing for you to be able to sit here and laugh with me. Every time I share what it was like, I relive it. And yet I can see the humor in it. And the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous is that there is some humor in it. And the door of the sick mind opens from the inside. And the reason we got to be able to laugh at these things is because if we can laugh at these things, little by little the door might open. And the reason we can laugh at these things like we just did is that if we can get that door open, it gives us a chance to stick the answer in. And that's the only reason that we can laugh at those things and should laugh at those things and keep it the light touch. Because I'm going to tell you what happened in my life, there ain't nothing cute or funny about it. Nothing cute or funny. I don't know whether you identify with it or not. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But you could. In the next 4 years of my life, being the very best father that I could be, the very best father that I could be. I have an experience. I don't know what time it was, 2 o'clock in the afternoon maybe. One of them times a day when I needed something bad. And the only money that I knew where we had around that house anywhere was in my daughter's piggy bank. And being the very best father that I could be, in the middle of that afternoon, I got on my hands and knees and I broke her piggy bank in her bedroom. And I'm down on my hands and knees and I'm separating the pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters because a big spinner like me ain't going to take no pennies down at that liquor store or at the connection house. I got to have at least have silver. And being the very best father I could be, I'm down on my hands and knees and I'm separating the pennies out of that silver and I get this little feeling, this little thing right at the base of your neck that you know somebody's watching you. And that little girl, nine and a half years old at that time, was like a wounded animal. And she had her chin on her chest and her hair was in her face and she was like a wounded animal, a scared little animal. And she wouldn't even sleep in her bed. Most of the time she hid in her closet. And that day, probably for some reason, and I don't even know why, she wasn't able to go to school. And she'd hid in that house. And that afternoon I'm on my hands and knees and I'm getting that money separated so I can go get me something to make me well or keep me going. And I had that feeling that somebody's watching me. And I, being the very best father I could be that day, I give her a break. I give that kid a break. Can you imagine that? I give her a break. I let her scoot behind me and get out the door without inflicting some kind of a painful memory on her. You see, because at that point in my life, if you catch me in that pitiful state of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, it is absolutely necessary for me to inflict some kind of a painful memory on you that overshadows what you just saw me. It is absolutely necessary. It's a bet. Sometimes I'd do it immediately, sometimes I'd wait. But it's absolutely necessary for me to inflict some kind of a painful memory on you that overpowers, overshadows, and takes the place of what you saw in me, being the very best father. Or maybe, I don't know what time it was, early in the morning, and I'm standing in that kitchen and I'm taking a drink off a bottle of vodka, and I look down the hallway and a little 10-year-old girl standing down at the end of that hallway, and she's got her chin on her chest and her hair's in her face, and she didn't run down that hallway and say, "Daddy, come play with me. She didn't. She looks at me down at the end of that hallway, and I look at her, and I turn back around, and I take a drink out of that bottle, because I got no choice. And when I look back, she's gone. All she wants to know is which direction I'm going so she can go the other way. Or maybe, I don't know what time it is, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, I shoot straight up out of my own bed. And that lady that's sitting here in this front row, she don't look like she does tonight. She's got a black eye and a busted lip. And I wake up 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, come shooting straight up out of that bed, and I look at her, and I'm pretty sure I had something to do with that. And I run down a hallway, and I go in that room, and I try to find that little girl. I know she's in there somewhere, and I find her in that closet, and she's trying to sleep, and I put my ear down there by her mouth, and I listen. I listen to see if she's breathing, because it's just a matter of time until I take her life. Just a matter of time. And the reason I got to do that is, you see, because I'm that kind of an alcoholic. If you love me, I got to prove you don't. You see, you either attract the things you fear the most, or you attract the things you love the most. That's just the difference between the way I live today and the way I used to live. You know, it's just as simple as, today I live it one day at a time, and I used to live like there's no tomorrow. And today I just attract the things I love the most. But at a point in time in my life, I had to attract the things I feared the most. Absolutely necessary for me to destroy everything around me. You see, I'm that kind of an alcoholic. As long as there's one man, woman, child, dog, or cat that'll roll over when I snap my fingers, I'm not going to do nothing about me. As long as I got one enabler, I'll step on your back to raise me up out of that gutter. I will. Matter of fact, I run out of friends and enemies at the same time. I run them all off. I had to run them all off. And I crawled out of one of them drunken stupors one more time. And I don't know when it is. It's just time, I suppose. Time is a necessary thing. I didn't pick a day. It was just one of those days where I couldn't stand me anymore. And I wasn't living and I wasn't dying. And I couldn't stand the way I was living and I couldn't stand the way I was dying. It's taken too long. And for some reason, maybe because the seed of Alcoholics Anonymous had been planted, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous because it was the only place I had to go. I didn't have no other choices. I didn't go because I was in jail and they said we're going to have an AA meeting. I went down to get a cup of coffee. Or I didn't go because I wanted to come and be with you. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous because it's the last house on the block. And through a series of events and the people that believed in Alcoholics Anonymous, a little gray-headed man made a 12-step call on me and came to the house and he told me some things. And for some period of seconds or moments, a heartbeat, that point, reference point in our life where we can hear something, I heard something. And what I heard him say is, you don't ever have to take a drink again as long as you live if you don't want to. And I couldn't even comprehend how you could do that. That's where I was at that point in time. But he set the hook. You know, I love the old timers and Alcoholics Anonymous because they know how to set the hook. And he knew I didn't know how to stay sober. Maybe he said that for himself. But he set the hook when he said, you don't ever have to be lonely again as long as you live. And God, I knew that loneliness. I knew that loneliness inside of me, that the whole, in my gut, man, the wind blew through that, and I had no feelings, no emotions. I'd long since turned those things off. I had that down pat. And yet something inside, the emptiness, that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization that you're not nothing. It's like, you know, every family has to have a bad example, and I'm it, man. When I was a little kid and I grew up around them churches, they said, you know, if you don't do this and you do that and you're going to do this, you're going to end up going to hell. I volunteered, man. Somebody's got to go, I'll go. The problem was I just wasn't getting there fast enough. And when that little gray-headed man set the hook in me, I followed him. And I think that's probably the greatest reference point of my entire life. I followed a complete stranger across the room, and he told me, come go with me, and I followed him. I believed in him. God, that's so important. That is so important. If you're new or relatively new, or if you've been around here a long time, God, I hope you don't forget that moment of willingness to follow a complete stranger. The reason I was willing to follow that guy is because I felt safe. God, with the kind of fear I live with, I was a scared little boy that grew up to be a scared little boy. And when that guy told me to come go with him, I felt safe. God, if you're new, I hope you feel safe here tonight. If you don't get nothing else out of this deal, you're safe here. At least for this moment, for this point of reference in time.
You're saved. And that's exactly what I felt. And I believe. There has to be some feeling of faith. There has to be some feeling of trust. Of course, it's short-lived because we're riddled with fear and anger and all those emotions when we're new. But I believe. And that guy took care of me. He took me where I belong. He took me where there were other alcoholics that understood me. And he put me with these alcoholics, and they literally loved me back to health. And I wasn't lovable. I'm not one of them people that come to Alcoholics Anonymous and put the plug in the jug and was wonderful. I was nuts. I was absolutely nuts. I'd take three steps and cry and three steps and laugh. Just nuts. Just absolutely crazy. Just riddled with anger. I didn't know what to do with those emotions. I didn't know how to deal with those emotions. And these people were talking to me about anger. I remember one time they were talking about anger, and I just got so angry because they were talking about anger, and I went and told somebody, I said, they ain't talking about anger, they're talking about a temper tantrum. There's a difference between that and rage. Jeez, what am I going to do with this? And they said, pick up the chair, clean the ashtray, do it over here. You don't have to, you know, destroy everything around you. I didn't know what to do. I'd been married to this lady for a long time, and I didn't know whether she was my wife or my friend or my nurse or my bondsman or, you know, what she was. I didn't know what I was. I didn't know what she was. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous said, it doesn't really make any difference. It'll be the way it's supposed to be. Just don't drink today, no matter what. Even if your butt falls off, don't drink today. And I just held on. I just held on. They take me to meetings. I went to a lot of men's stags when I was new. I'm grateful for men's stags because I could identify. They taught my native tongue, profanity. And I could go in there and they talked about crazy things. They took me to these men's stag meetings and these guys were all nuts. They was in there talking about all this weird and sick stuff, you know, and I'd sit in there and I'd judge them, and I didn't quit carrying guns just because I was sober up, so I'd take my old gun out of my boot and maybe take a bullet out of it, and I'd take a Pentatel pen while a guy's sharing, I'd write his name on his bullet and hold it up. I'm going to kill you right after the meeting, dude. You're sick. Put the bullet back in my gun, put it back in my boot. Some other guy talk about sick stuff. And I think, get a bullet out and write his name on it and hold it up. I'm going to kill you right after the meeting. Then the meeting would be over, they'd all stand up and pray. And I think, well, I forgot who I was going to kill first. I'll just come back next week and throw a grenade in here and kill them all. You know? They put their arms around me and said, we love you. I mean, they put their arms around me, and one old guy put his arms around me and held on to me. I tried to get away. He wouldn't let me go. Yeah. If you don't let go of me, I'm going to kick you. Yeah. Just hold on to me. Just hold me. And I didn't know whether I was walking or riding a bicycle. I didn't know if it was Frank or Ernest. I didn't know where I was going. I had so many costumes. I remember I was pretty new. And you know, I'd gone back home, and I'm trying to do the right thing. I don't know what's happening. And Sue's going to Al-Anon, and the kid's going to Alley Teen, and the dog's going to Alley Dog, and the cat's going to Alley Cat. And they assigned me this sponsor, a guy by the name of Rotten Ron. He's crazy. He's going to meetings all the time. I had a van full of old newcomers all the time, and I'm going to these meetings. And, you know, I didn't, just crazy. I had problems. You know, the book said waves of the past will roll over us when we come here to Alcoholics. I had some big waves, man, and they're following me. I got people going to kill me if I don't pay them the money back. I got problems. I said, don't worry about it. It'll all be all right. Don't drink. Go to a meeting. And, one Saturday morning, Sue's talking to her sponsor, and I got to go to a meeting. I'm just nuts. You know, Saturday morning, crazy. I don't know what I'm going to. And so I went in, and I decided, well, I think I'll be a cowboy. So I put my boots on, my Levi's, my other vest, my hat, and I went out, and she's talking to her sponsor, so I kissed her goodbye. Went out and got my pickup truck, backed it down the driveway, went down the street about a block and a half. There's a stop sign down there, and I looked in the rearview mirror, and nope, don't want to be a cowboy. Turned it around, went back home, parked it, went in, waved at her, went in, took off my hat and my boots and everything. And I think, well, I think I'll be a biker. So I go in and I put on my leathers, you know, and my bandana, and I go out and kiss her goodbye. She's still talking to her sponsor. I go out in the garage and fire my big hog up and rack her back and get on and blow down the street and the stop sign and stop and look in the rearview mirror a minute. Nope, that ain't it. Go back to the house, drop it off, wave at her, go in. I think, well, I think I'll put a three-piece suit on. I went in and put a three-piece suit on, you know, went out, kissed her goodbye. She's still talking to her sponsor, and I get in the big iron, drive it down the street a block or two, stop at the light and look in the rearview mirror. Nope, that ain't it. Back to the house, take off that suit, went in, put on my jogging uniform, and I went out and kissed her goodbye, and I jogged to the meeting. Her sponsor says, how many people live in that house? She's all just Juan Nauke. He don't know who he is today. I didn't know who I was. I had it narrowed down, though. You know? It's crazy. He was getting on, so I went up in Wyoming, hanging out, hiding out in Evanston, Wyoming, going to meetings in Evanston, Wyoming. Nut ward, man. You can be a spiritual giant up there without any effort at all. Everybody's wandering around on Thorazine. I'd go up there going to meetings, hiding out. And after I'd been there a while, I went home, and I went back down to the house. And I hadn't been home for a month or so, and I run in. I said, "Get in the bedroom. I'm horny." She said, "Oh, I've been going to Al-Anon, and I've done a little sex inventory here, and I discovered that you haven't made love to me in 10 years. You've raped me for the last 10 years. I said, "The hell you say?" She said, "Matter of fact, you're sleeping on the couch. Spiritual giant like me, I've saved myself for you." I went in and laid down on the couch, and I'm thinking about all this. About midnight, them hippies next door decided to mow their backyard. She come running down the hallway and said, "They're back in the backyard mowing their weeds. Got to do something." I jumped up off that couch, run down the hall, grabbed my .44 mag, went out in the back, leaned over the fence. That hippie's out there mowing the weeds, loaded on LSD, and I just killed his lawnmower right in the middle. Boom! Realized that big around. She ran out and put her arms around and said, "Oh, Daddy, I just love you when you're a hero." Took me in there and throwed one on me, you know. And them people moved out in a few days. I single-handedly cleaned up a neighborhood that was corrupt for years, man. I know that sounds crazy, but that's the way it was. I didn't know what was going on. They told me to clean up, shape up, show up, and I just trying to do the drill, you know, just trying to do whatever, you know, take care of business. And I remember one time I decided, you know, better get all decked out, and I had a long beard and long hair when I sobered up, so I went and got my beard trimmed and got my hair. Went by this clothing store, I think it's time to get me some new thread, so I went in and I got this clothing salesman to fix me all up, man. He had me super neat suit and had reversible vest, how you could wear it for a while one side and then turn it around the other, had a tie, you could turn it around the other way. Got some underwear too, you know. Sober a while, you gotta start wearing underwear. Socks. Man, that dude fixed me all up. And I'd stop by and a buddy of mine had a used car lot and he fixed me up with a big iron. Gotta have a big iron. You're sober a while, prosperity sets in. And I put on my big suit and I got that big iron and took it down to the club, man. Pulled that big, I had a big Lincoln, big Mark IV Lincoln, big old long hood way out there, hood ornament, man. I pulled that baby right out in front of that Alano Club and parked it out there so the newcomers would have hope. You know? I'd worked all the steps, you know. Couldn't say nothing because I was biting the bullet so hard, you know. Sit around and radiate hate. Just people come sit down next to me and get up and leave and they wouldn't come back, you know. Go to this club and my sponsor stood on one side of the room, made me stand on the other. He'd point at me, way back there. You know, newcomers would come in, he'd grab them and he'd talk to them and he'd point at me. Asked one of them newcomers, I said, "What did my sponsor say about me?" He said, "He told me that if I go back out, I'm liable to end up like you." Said, "You're as well as you're ever going to be." I know. I was standing here one day just radiating hate. I had so many guns on me, if you'd have bumped into me, there'd have been a mushroom cloud, you know, just. And I looked around and there's a weirdo standing next to me. Weirdest looking guy you ever seen. Man, he wasn't tall enough to be a man. He wasn't short enough to be a man. Just kind of in here. You know, had hair sticking everywhere. Had a funny little hat with strawberry and cherry like a welder wears, pulled over to the side and down. Just, I'd seen him the meeting the night before. He's the treasurer of the meeting the night before. I'd gone and asked for a treasurer's report and he said, "I stole all the money and I ain't paying it back." And they said, "You got to keep doing it until you get it right." Darnest thing I ever seen in my life. And here this guy standing next to me. I said, "Why don't you comb your hair?" And he said, "I did." I said, "Hell, you did." He said, "Will you be my sponsor?" I said, "Oh, Jesus. Man, I can't even take care of myself. I'm about to die." And, well, I don't know. I have to go ask my sponsor. So I went over to where my sponsor's standing. And I said, "See that weirdo over there?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "He just asked me to be his sponsor." My sponsor said the dumbest thing. He said, "Yeah, I know. I sent him over there." He said, "You go back over there and tell him you'll be his sponsor and do exactly what he said." Now, that don't even make sense to me today. If I'm supposed to be his sponsor, why do I got to do what he said? I didn't argue with my sponsor. I was kind of thinking maybe I'd kind of like to have a parole officer or maybe a lawyer ask me to be their sponsor, or a doctor or somebody like that. Wasn't happening. So I went back over to that weirdo and I said, my sponsor says I got to be your sponsor. What do you want to do? He says, I want to go for a ride in your Lincoln. Well, you go out that door and I'll go out this door and I'll meet you at the big iron. He said, no, I want to go with you. And he grabbed me around the arm and we took off walking to the door. A couple of guys I knew leaned against the door jamb over there. When he got over there by him, he says, that's my sponsor. Man, don't tell people I'm your sponsor. They said, boy, it's going to be fun watching you two grow. I get that weirdo in that car and he'd start talking sick stuff to me. Sick stuff. And then right in the middle of it, he'd say, you ever do anything like that? And I'd say, yeah, I did some stuff like that. And I'd start telling him some of my stuff. And he'd say, man, you're sick. We need to go to a meeting. And we'd go to a meeting, sit on the front row and listen to the speaker. That's why they have speakers, so you can bring newcomers up there and they can sit in the front and listen to it, and then you can take them out in the car and tell them what the speaker said. So I'd have to explain all that. So I'd get him out in my big Lincoln and explain to him what it was the speaker said. And a couple of times he tried to argue with me. He went and got the Bible. He said, I've been reading the Bible, and he says, all this spiritual stuff means that we need a spiritual experience. We need a miracle. He said, in the Bible, they have them. Had to. Parting the water in a burning bush. I was saying, if I had some lighter fluid, I could torch the hedge over here, you know. Had an old 45 in the glove box. I whipped it out, jacked the shell in that chair, showed it upside his head, and I said, I'll tell you what, dude, I'll count to 10, you pray. If this gun don't go off, believe in God. Counted 10, laid the hammer back, threw it back in the glove box, and he ain't had a drink since. I know that sounds crazy, but it works. I don't recommend it for everybody, but some of them you got to get their attention. However, he did jump out of that car and run around yelling and screaming three or four times, went back in that meeting hall where my sponsor was and rat-finked on me. Told my sponsor I stuck a 45 upside his head and made him take the third step. My sponsor says, yeah, I know, ain't he spiritual? He'd talk to me about sick stuff, and I'd have to tell him some of my sick stuff. A couple times I had to lie to him, because you can't let them one-up you, you know. I grew up on a farm, and he's a city boy. I could always top him in the sex department. A couple of times he said, I know you lied to me, because it's physically impossible to do some of the things you said you did. I ain't cop a plea. You know, I was taking him all in meetings. One Sunday morning, I had my little routine. Sunday morning, I'd do my meditation, and by then I'd moved out of the old neighborhood and had some good things happen. By the time I was 3.5 years sober, I had a concrete driveway. Can you believe that? Brand new concrete driveway, no oil spots in it. I was proud of that. Matter of fact, I told the people, if you come over to my house, if you got stickers on them cars, don't park it out in front of my house. Don't want my new neighbors to know I'm one of you. You know. I don't want no newcomers' cars in my driveway because they leak oil. Reading a little spiritual meditation, TM or something like that, and I'm in there doing that, and all of a sudden knock at the front door. I went to the front door, opened the front door, and there's Weirdo standing there. Man, it looked like half of him is stuck in concrete, and the other half of him is going to Tijuana. He's got a big book of paper stuck in it. His old car's in my new driveway with oil running right down the driveway. Stickers all over that car, you know, AA. Man, look, the neighbor's going to see all that. What do you want? And he said, I want to work the steps like you did. I said, yeah, I know I did them. Hurry up, get in here quick before my neighbors see you. So I got him in the house, and I said, the first step says I'm powerless. I'm sure of that because you're in my house. I said, my life's unmanageable. I'm pretty sure of that because it looks like you're going to stay a while. Second step says something about being restored to sanity. I'm sure you're crazy, and I understand you, so we must be on step three. And so I had to get on my knees with another human being and do that third step before it's right. So he got on his knees right in my kitchen and said, get down here. So I got down beside him on my knees and we opened the big book up in the third step prayer. And he cuddled up underneath my arm and we read that third step prayer together, you know, and a cat walked by and looked at us weird. And I thought, man, if my wife sees me on my knees, this weirdo down here, she'll know I've whacked out for sure. But then he jumped up and said, I want to do my fourth step. And I said, I got you now, sucker. You're supposed to have that done before you get to your sponsor's house. And he said, well, I can't write. And he threw a bunch of paper and a pencil in front of me, and he said, I'll talk you right. And he started talking. I started writing. I'm writing away. And pretty soon he said, you ever do anything like that? And I said, yeah, I did some stuff like that. And I started telling some of my stuff. And matter of fact, a couple of things came up. I forgot to tell my sponsor when I did my fifth step. I knew God's in the room, and he couldn't read, so I just put some of my stuff in his. What the heck, you know? We burn it. That's what it's all about anyway. Get it out, man. And pretty soon that guy jumped up, ran around there, kissed me on the cheek and said, I love you. I thought, well, that's it. Divorce her and follow him. Hell, I don't know. He ran out of the front yard, waved real big, said, I love you. And I thought, well, now the neighbors know. You know what I mean? But I know something that day as a result of that. That's the first time in my entire life that I ever got out of myself for any period of time. That's the very first time in my entire life. 3.5 years sober, sitting around meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, dying inside. You see, I know today that's exactly why I had to do a fifth step. I had to do a fifth step because then it qualified me to receive a fifth step. And until you have received a fifth step, you have not made full circle. And whenever you make full circle, there isn't a magic there. It is in forgiving that we are forgiven. And I could sit around meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous 3.5 years sober, dying inside. Because I'm my own worst judge, jury, and executioner. And I could sit in like it's tattooed on my forehead. You ain't nothing. You ain't never going to be nothing. And I could sit in the back of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and literally die, physically die inside, sober, going crazy, sitting in here feeling unworthy, knowing beyond a shadow of a doubt that I'm different, being different. And that day sitting there, you know, with that guy, and he's sharing his deepest, darkest secrets with me. And I'm sharing my deepest, darkest secrets with another human being other than my sponsor. And a little bit of honesty, a little bit of spirituality happens when one drunk talks to another drunk. Because that's what this is, one drunk talking to another drunk. In such a language, the language of the heart that you can understand and understand that you're not different. That the feelings are the same and you're home. You're really where you're supposed to be. And there is hope. And there is faith. There is trust. See, I didn't understand those things. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my values were all wrong. I didn't know those things. I said, I don't trust nobody. The reason I don't trust nobody is because I'm not trustworthy. It's not you, it's me. And sitting there listening to that guy talk about those things and the way he treated his family. And he had a little girl, and he talked to me about his little girl. And what he told me is that he was sitting there, he'd been sober a while, and his little girl came home from school one day, and she'd made one of those little flowers where you fold the paper up and you cut it out, and she'd come home from school and she crawled up on his lap and she opened this flower up and there was a whole bunch of little flowers tied together and she said, Daddy, I want to give you a flower that'll never die. And that ding-a-ling cried. Can you imagine that? And I told him about, I've been sober a little while, and my daughter came home one day and asked me what I was doing on Saturday, and I didn't necessarily go to a meeting. And she said, well, why don't you come by, give me a little piece of paper with an address on it, and said, come down there. And unbeknownst to me, she'd gone to Alatine, and she got some self-worth, and she'd done something for herself. She had enrolled in a modeling class, and she went down to this place, and she was finishing this, beginner's modeling class. And I walked in a room big as this, and I leaned up against the wall back there, you know, and had a stage up here, and pretty soon a bunch of little girls started coming out on the stage, and pretty soon my little girl come walking out on that stage and she seen me standing back there. It wasn't hard to miss. I was leaning against the wall back there and terminally cool and she gave me the high sign, you know, and she walked out on that stage and, you know, I wanted to scream at those people in that room, you know. They didn't know me from Adam. They didn't know that kid. But something inside of me wanted to scream. If you only knew the hell that kid up there on that stage, if you only knew where that kid come from, you'd stand up and applaud her. And the minute I had that thought leaning against that wall, I thought, you know, I can't take credit for this. All I've been doing is just coming to these stupid AA meetings. Kids found something in Alatine and found a loving God that gave her the willingness to look beyond where others had feared to go, and she was doing something for herself. I couldn't take credit for nothing. Being the very best father I could be, almost destroyed her. But what I could tell that guy about was leaning against that wall that day. I let some of them tears come down. You know, not tears of sorrow, tears of joy. Daddy tears. And, you know, tried to bite a hole in my lip from keeping from showing that ding-a-ling, those emotions. But you know how your old jaw quivers a little bit? Me and that ding-a-ling sit there at my kitchen table and cry. You don't let somebody see that. You don't let somebody see those kind of emotions. You don't let anybody see those. If you let anybody see those emotions, they'll turn them around and use them against you and make fun of you. And yet, there's an amazing thing about the language of the heart. If you have the language of the heart, There are no roadblocks for those feelings. And you can be a human being. You just be a human being. Claim your emotion. I'm not riddled with guilt. And sitting there that day, that's the thing that I could share with that guy. I didn't look down on him from where he'd been or where he'd come from. I loved him more because of that. And that's what I come to understand. That's what it's all about. Don't, if you're new, man, don't look for something that ain't here. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been involved in Alcoholics Anonymous from the moment I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, May 11, 1976, to this second right now. And it's my life. I'm obsessed with Alcoholics Anonymous. And an obsession is an idea that overpowers all other ideas. And I can only afford one obsession. And I'm not going to stand here and tell you that my sobriety has been a cakewalk. Not at all. It's been my sobriety lives worse than a lot of people's drunk a lot, because the amazing thing was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I brought me, the sum total of me. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous is I started just doing the drill. I started working with these newcomers because that's the foundation I stand on. Work the steps the best of your ability and work with a newcomer. Talk to a sponsor. Strong sponsorship. You know, I'm a product of strong sponsorship. The reason I got to have a sponsor is because if I don't have a sponsor, an idiot's running my life. Me. And I have to have that kind of sponsorship. And I'm grateful for that. And I've gone through a lot of things in sobriety. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have literally walked me through. God bless the old timers. You know, the service is an extremely important part of my sobriety. Because service is gratitude in action. Service is humility in action. And service is a very important part of my sobriety. It's not so I can get an AA resume. It's because it allows me to interact with people. You can stand around at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and lean against the wall and be real cool while you die inside. It takes guts to step off that wall and take a commitment and doing something.